Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, I'm Cheryl.
I'm Maxine.
This is First Check, part of Day One, the network dedicated to founders, operators, and investors.
If you want to be a better early stage investor, this is the show for you.
So TLDR, if you don't want to suck at investing, listen up.
Alrighty.
Excellent. Okay, so this next guest is somebody that I have known pretty much as long as I've been investing, and much longer than that. In fact, he helped me get into angel investing. He helped me write my first couple of checks. I don't think I would be where I am today if it wasn't for Matt Brown from Black Nova.
Yeah, he was your gateway, right, into this ecosystem. And I think actually has been, you know, a supporting member of this ecosystem for so long, and it has been the gateway for a lot of folks into this world. He also, you know, has been an operator before, which is a fairly rare thing in the investor group in the Australian ecosystem. So super excited to have him on, to have him kind of riff a little bit on what are the similarities, what are the differences, talk a little bit about how he nerds out on boring businesses. I love the way he thinks about founding, he thinks about building. He's kind of an interesting combination of experiences that he is just, I think, a real value add to have around the table as an investor. So I am jazzed to get to be able to spend an hour with him just to nerd out with him on these businesses.
Oh yeah, I think he has such a unique perspective on investing. Like, they're very thematic, but that comes from his experience as, like, he built a company, he exited a company, he's built several companies. Actually, the number of companies that Matt has co-founded is hilarious. I'm like, oh, you co-founded that one as well. Yes. Okay, great. Of course.
Serial founder can't stop himself. I guess that's like one way to scratch that itch is, like, instead of you founding the companies, go and other founders founding that company so you could be a little bit along for the journey with them.
Yeah. He's just like surrounded by founders constantly, and excellent founders too. And he is himself one. And I'm excited to ask him about, like, what has it been like to actually, like, co-found a funds management company, because that's what he's done, right? Like, they are now building a different type of company that invests people's money.
Yeah, very different kind of business. I'm so excited to dive in.
Yeah, let's get into it. Matt, you are somebody that I have known a really long time, and I got into, I think I was one of the first people that got into your fund, but, and you helped me make my first investment, I think, or at least one of the first. So I'm really curious, what was your very first investment?
My very first investment, like, obviously outside of my own businesses, was a business called MeFleet, and it was both my first investment and my first failed investment. It was an area of expertise that I had. It was in the procurement space. It was helping consumers access better deals that were procured by procurement experts. It's kind of like a group buying, early group buying kind of app, predominantly focused on motor vehicle ownership. And look, the idea was really good. The product itself was really good. The deals that they'd managed to get on board the platform were really good. Their acquisition of customers sucked. And I think that was the challenge. And, you know, it's interesting. As an investor, I'm a thematic investor, especially these days. I only back the stuff I really deeply know and know how to scale. That business, consumer software, is definitely not my areas of expertise. So it kind of reminds me, you should stick to the things you know and trust others to stick to the things you don't.
That's amazing.
That's definitely something I learned from my early investments as well.
Yeah. And your first ever investment, like, in your life was a startup.
It was. Yeah. So
that's so cool.
I guess technically that's a lie, in that I was on performance bonus shares in corporate. And so I had, you know, public stock. But the first investment that I made where I thought about it outside of home ownership or my own businesses was absolutely a startup. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I don't know if we've ever talked to, like, so far, no one has answered that question, that their very first investment was an actual startup. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty cool. I will say there's a couple of people that have been like, they've counted their first home as their first investment. And so I'm sure if we, like, excluded that from the data set, be like, sorry, you can't choose that. It would be interesting to see what their first investment was. But yeah, that's so impressive. And also, like, true to form, I feel like you are startup through and through. You know, you live, breathe, eat startups.
Bleed.
I bleed startups.
I bleed a lot. Bleeding heart.
Actually, one of the things that I'm super interested to get into with you today is this idea of a, like, boring B2B SaaS. I feel like VC is kind of thrown around a lot. People talk about, like, loving boring, etc. And I don't think a lot of people actually talk about, like, what is it? Why do we like it? Generally speaking, if someone says boring, they're not
it's not a positive thing. So like, why is it positive in venture? Can you give us a little like masterclass on like, why is boring in B2B SaaS interesting? And why do you like to invest in it?
Yeah, so I think like when I use the word boring, it's not boring at all. Like it's actually, you know, they're really interesting problems that they're solving for really critical sort of business buying decisions and for critical business processes. So it's not boring in the sense of, you know, there is an audience for it. They love it. They're absolutely mad fans of the types of software that I invest in. However, you know, if you compare it to putting first humans on Mars or, you know, delivery food or, you know, like... The next cure for XYZ disease, like it's a little bit more boring, a little bit more traditional. You know, where I really focus on is, and we use this term more than boring these days, mission critical unturnoffable software. So it's the sorts of things that businesses buy, they have to buy. It's either a legislative tailwind, it's public pressure, it's board pressure, or it's you know, core to how their business operates day to day. When they buy, they will go, you know, there is already a budgeted line item to buy that thing. You know, they're not having to think about it. There's not usually a lot of education required. When they buy it, they typically buy for a long time. They typically pay upfront annually. That upfront revenue helps the business to be a lot more resilient to capital market changes. And in many ways, the sorts of things we back are somewhat recession-proof. And so nothing's truly recession-proof, but if you're investing in supply chain software and your business has a core element of supply chain, it wouldn't matter if there's World War III. As long as your business is still operating, you need to operate an effective supply chain, probably even more so during a war. And so, you know, boring for us is about the core inputs to operating a successful enterprise business. And so we're looking for founders that are building the picks and shovels, the things that those companies that, you know, Commonwealth Bank or Telstra or Home Depot or whoever will purchase and then hold for the long term and not turn off.
It reminds me of, you know how people refer to Bikini, like there's like a Bikini with the nickname Tiny, who's actually like the largest human you've ever come across. And it's kind of like the same name, but for like investing, right? It's like deeply not boring. It's really interesting, really excellent businesses, or making assumptions about the fact that you can never turn it off, right? LTV would be pretty tasty on those kind of businesses. And so it's kind of like an ironic name.
It is, and LTV is about as good as it gets. You know, I reflect on when I built my first software business, DoneSafe, in the 7.5-8 years that I operated that company. We only had one enterprise customer churn, and you know, like and we had hundreds of customers, and you know, sort of fairly significant ARR at exit, and even more significant ARR 4 years later. And you know, most of the customers that I sold to are still customers of the acquiring company that bought our company. And so, I just think, for me, if you can find a really acute problem that a business has and you can solve it effortlessly, and you can also make sure that you give, you know, outsized customer service and support to that enterprise and make the enterprise buyer look good and all of those sorts of things, not only do they buy it for their business and it's got a really long LTV, but when, you know, a corporate employee moves from one enterprise to another, they typically go and buy that software again. So your one-time sales effort can sometimes magnify 3 or 4 times across the life of you owning your enterprise software business. You're the same person I sold to at National Australia Bank brought it to Telstra, the same person that I sold to at SkyCity took it to a bunch of other places. And so we're looking for investing in those types of businesses.
But like, you must get tons of B2B SaaS companies that come to you, right? Because like pretty much every VC in Australia does B2B SaaS. Like, what are the things when you see one that comes to you, like, that's in the boring category? Like, what are the attributes? What are the things that you look for to be like, that one's in the boring, but not boring category?
I love that we're using it as a term of art now. And it's like, boring is a positive thing. Oh, you're so boring. Yeah. I'm going to start using it to see how it lasts.
Maxine, you're so boring.
If it wasn't for Elon Musk starting his boring business and calling it boring, I would have probably called Black Nova boring.vc. But, you know, that was kind of taken by Elon with his boring company.
You can do missioncritical.vc now.
Yeah. Well, I have unturnoffable.com. That's one of my domain names. So we'll probably do something with that one day. No, I don't think we'll change the fund name, but I'm sure we'll do something with it. But look, I think the way that I think about it is, if you're sitting in a back office function of an enterprise, you know, if you're in the risk team, you're using risk management software. If you're in the procurement supply chain team, you're using procurement and supply chain software. If you're sitting in HR, you have, you know, HRIS, and you have some supplementary tools to manage your people and culture. If you're in finance, you know, you're using the finance section of an ERP, you're using accounting software, you're using cash flow management software. It's looking at like what are the things that you absolutely have to do your job, and if you didn't have them, your job would be back to being manual and 10 times harder, and where the value exchange is at least 5 times greater. So, you know, your software costs you $100,000 a year, but it gives you $500,000 worth of cost savings minimum. Like, it's that's the stuff that we get really excited about. For us, when we invest, it's not just about the boring problem that they're solving, but it's also about the person solving it. Did they come from an area of domain expertise? You know, have they felt this problem themselves? Have they tried to solve it themselves when they've sat inside an enterprise, or have they tried to solve it themselves, you know, when they've been consulting to an enterprise on that problem and they've now found that software is the best way to solve it?
Because I imagine, I mean, it just occurred to me for the benefit of the folks listening to this, if you kind of the fundamentals of why that's so attractive to have a business that LTV sounds like it's pretty huge, right? Because it lasts for so long. For the benefit of the audience, LTV stands for lifetime value, i.e. how much revenue that customer is worth to you over an extended period of time. And I think the insight that you just shared there, where like you can actually, sure, the enterprise sales motion is quite long, but even if, you know, it does take a while, you get more than compensated for that on the back end because this revenue profile for these businesses is so long. And even better, you sell to them one time and they then move on to various other organizations that kind of bring this product with them. And so your effective like cost to acquire or CAC, customer acquisition cost, is super low. And so just from a bottoms up perspective, it doesn't cost you that much to find them. Software, in theory, has marginal cost for delivery, so it doesn't cost you much to service them, maybe some account management cost, etc. And then you have kind of locked in long-term revenue on top of that, means that you have a really performant business in the long term. What about the competitive dynamics for these kinds of boring businesses, right? And do we like them because no one else wants to touch them, or are they actually surprisingly competitive because turns out boring's hot?
Well, I think there are absolutely big areas of competition. I think what's really interesting, though, and you know, as somebody who built my own software businesses, went through things like Y Combinator was one of them, and has worked on accelerator programs both here and overseas. I think that, you know, if you're a 25-year-old who's just finished their university degree and you're building your first SaaS business, you're probably not thinking about building the next, you know, risk management software for third line risk in a bank. Like, that's probably not what you're waking up to do. You're not going at 25 going, fuck, I just want to solve third line risk. Like, that's all I want to do.
That's totally what I was thinking about at 25, Matt. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, reading my diary, it's pages and pages of third line risk in banks.
And so, you know, you don't have like that kind of, and not to say that everybody young is hungry, but you don't have that kind of atypical Silicon Valley young, hungry group of five engineers that have just finished Stanford that are sitting together, hacking together something to solve that problem. And so that removes a number of the typical competitors you have. Like, if you're investing in software that sells to software businesses, then, you know, you've got a shitload of competitors to think about. But, you know, if you're thinking about HRIS, or you're thinking about supply chain, or you're thinking about risk management, or you're thinking about call center optimization, or you're thinking about plastic reduction, maybe more plastic reduction, there's some young people thinking about that. But like, there's definitely an area of kind of gray hair that kind of comes into the founders building those businesses. And so I think that does reduce some of the competition. You also have a lot of companies, like you have a lot of cottage industries in these spaces. So you'll end up with a lot of people that will build small to medium software businesses serving one vertical or serving one geography, that will be run by a domain expert who doesn't go for venture capital, doesn't have global domination on their mind. And so when you find a founder who has the right level of domain expertise, who has the ambition to build a really big, you know, long-standing business, and is able to then attract funding through an investor like myself, then they have a real chance of taking a large chunk of the market. And over time, you know, they may choose to, you know, partner with venture or private equity to start acquiring the small cottage industry businesses that are in there, because it's cheaper to acquire their customers than it is to sell to their customers. And so I think that's one of the things that I really like about the space that I play in. There is absolutely competition, but probably a little bit less than the next kind of, you know, dev tools or productivity tool or consumer facing marketplace or whatever they might be.
Super cool. Are the businesses, like, can you build these huge businesses within the four walls of Australia, or do you generally look at kind of international scope businesses?
Look, I think that if you're an enterprise software business, unless you're talking about probably two or three core disciplines, you have to be an international business. Australia is a great first market. You know, we've got relatively mature buying cycles that happen with enterprise. Enterprises do in Australia give startups a go and, like, will buy from a smaller business because of the nature and geography that we sit in. And yet you're dealing with often, you know, global 500 companies that are headquartered in Australia. So you do have that opportunity to really test out enterprise software locally. The reality is, if you want to build a really big business, and, you know, without using the typical unicorn or decacorn kind of terminology, if you want to build a business that grows to 50 or a million or 100 million in annual recurring revenue, outside of a couple of core disciplines in B2B, it's hard to do that just in Australia. You're absolutely going to have to go into other markets. Now, that doesn't mean you have to necessarily go and move to Silicon Valley to do that. Like, you could absolutely be doing that in Australia and then going into Southeast Asia next, or the UK next, or Canada next, or Germany next, or wherever it might be. But, you know, you will have to have at least a few markets to get to that $50 to $100 million of ARR, typically outside of, as I said, probably a couple of small categories.
And you can also do that from Australia. You don't necessarily have to go move to the US.
100%.
No, you definitely don't have to move. However, I think that there is a benefit to founders spending time in the markets that they're selling to and spending at least a reasonable amount of time. When I was launching DoneSafe in the US, you know, I went and spent sort of 6 months in residence in the US, and then I was doing 8 to 10 trips a year to the US. I really don't think founders can ever move away from selling their product completely. And, you know, the founder is the best person with the right energy and the right insights to spend some time in the markets they want to launch in, even if they're not going to become residential permanently.
Yeah. So speaking of DoneSafe, you obviously went from, you obviously invested first, but focus more on you were founder first, started doing some angel investing, then built a fund. Can you comment a little bit on, like, that journey and how has it changed you as an investor? Like, what does that mean for you when you start to deploy your own capital, having that experience as a fund, as a founder to begin with?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, when I built DoneSafe, there was very little capital available in Australia. You know, there was probably four or five VC funds, with only two or three that had enough funds to actually deploy into anything at the point that we launched DoneSafe. And, you know, Blackbird had already backed Safety Culture, so they were out. And, we ended up getting a check from Adventure Capital, which is now my business partner in Black Nova, Darcy Naunton's first VC fund.
He obviously liked you enough.
Yeah, they put a grand total of $200,000. The last $200,000 they had in the kitty, they put into our business, and then we ended up returning their fund. So it was a good outcome for them, a good outcome for us as well, because I'd racked up about $100,000 of credit card debt to get the thing off the ground and as my business partner. And so, you know, I think, like, as a founder who's been on that journey and has understood what building a business means and what working with scarce capital means, you know, I worked in the scarce times, and, you know, we've just come out of a couple of years of abundance and into scarcity again over the last couple of years. And so, you know, I think that definitely gives you both some empathy, but some insight into what building a real company means and how to make your dollar stretch. And Aussies are known well for that in US investment circles as founders who know how to make the investment dollar stretch a lot further than a lot of other places in the world. And so I think that absolutely helps. And yet, even making that dollar stretch, typically they still perform like they do in the Olympics in the top couple in the world on a per capita basis, even with a lot less capital to play with. And so I think that's, you know, an insight you have from operating and raising money and building and then selling into US private equity. You kind of get a feel for what it looks like over there versus here and what it means to build something here. As an investor specifically, you know, it allows you to be a good reader of people. When you're building a company with scarce resources, you have to hire a lot of great people. You have to be very quick to say no. You have to say no a hell of a lot more than you say yes, because you just don't have the capital to say yes. And so that makes you a pretty good investor, because you have to say no a hell of a lot more than you say yes as an investor. I think when I look at the stage that we invest in, so we invest in pre-seed and seed. Our first fund, we did 35 investments. 28 of those investments were pre-seed investments. The majority of those investments we set terms on and led. And in our second fund, we're now doing our seventh investment. We've led, so of the six we've done, we've led 5 out of 6, and 4 out of 6 are typical pre-seed, pre-revenue businesses. Why I come to that is that, you know, I think when you're a later stage company, Series A, Series B, Series C, it very much becomes a finance person's game to invest. You know, I think when there's data, finance people can often make better, more unemotional decisions. When you're talking about 0 to 1, pre-seed and seed, I actually think operators make better investors. And the reason I believe that is, you know, at 0 to 1, there is no data to play with. You're validating people and their ability to get something done. Of course, you're doing market analysis to identify whether the timing's right and the market sizing's right and what the competitive landscape looks like and whether, you know, this is a thematic that you want to play in. But when you look at the actual individual founder, them building a product that didn't exist, then convincing people to pay for something that didn't exist 6, 12, 18 months ago, that's a founder's game. And I think, you know, I like to say that the later stage investing is science and the early stage investing is alchemy. And I'm, you know, like I look pretty good in a wizard's hat. So I think I've got the gray beard. So I tend to think that, you know, the founder expertise I've had building, scaling businesses, especially because we play thematically, I built mission critical enterprise software businesses. I invest in mission critical enterprise software businesses. There's a level of pattern matching and recognition that you get from there. There's an element of understanding what founders will be taken seriously by an enterprise buyer. There's an understanding of whether they have enough expertise to go and solve the problem. There's a level of understanding whether they have enough malleability and self-reflection to take on advice and not believe that what they're building is just for themselves, it's for others. And they're probably, if they're building it just for themselves, they've probably got a really small market to go after. So I think that's definitely the secret sauce to why we've performed as well as we have as an early stage thematic investor.
I think it's really interesting. So we had a woman called Trang from Transverse Partners on the podcast a little while ago now. They are both a fund of funds and a direct. And she made the point exactly just to kind of amplify that point you just made, which is like early stage investors and fund managers that get cut through in the early stage is so different than the fund managers and funds that win at the later stages. Because a big part of early stage is the people. Like the founders have to pick you as well to the same degree that you have to pick them. And getting cut through with the best founders, I think, is so crucial. And if you've done it before, like, it's so much easier than if you're coming at it like an investment banker, you know, and they're like, you just don't know what you're talking about.
I'm totally going to help your business.
Yeah. Let me talk about capitalizing your business and like, let me like just obsess over capital. And the founder's like, okay, like, have you ever paid payroll? Do you know what that's like? You know, like, I think it's a huge testament to you to actually like that you are building from that place and like building the fund from that place. I'll definitely say my experience, like obviously the building a fund is the first time I've built a company like this, and fund business management is so different. I was like really pleasantly and unpleasantly surprised by how different the business of funds management is relative to the business, like building other styles of businesses. But I'm interested in your perspective because I never built a like enterprise motion B2B SaaS business. Mine was much more kind of like consumer focused. All the businesses that I've ever built have been like, there was a lot of a difference between that kind of like go-to-market motion and those kind of things. But my sense is that building a funds management business actually is kind of similar to building a B2B SaaS business. But I'd love your thoughts, like what's similar, what's different, what have you learned from building fund management businesses that feel not obvious from the outside, and what is like nadir if you've built a company before, you're 100% you can build a fund?
Well, there's absolutely the no dir part around, you know, it is still a business. You've got to pay people, you've got to hire people, you've got to, you know, you do your annual returns, you've got to, there's auditing required, there's legals required. Like there's all the standards of running a business are there. What I often say to founders, you know, when I'm talking to founders, you know, they're doing their $1 million seed round or pre-seed round, I'm like, well, yeah, building a VC fund for the first time is like doing 25 seed rounds, except you can't have any of the same investors again. So it's like, that was probably the biggest lesson for me, is just how many people I'd have to talk to get a fund closed. I think after coming off a reasonably, you know, fast, accelerated growth corporate career into some reasonably successful software businesses, I thought it was probably going to be easier to build a fund than I did. I may have even at one stage said VC fund is kind of like my retirement job. It was just kind of a joke I probably made to some of the founders that were in my circle. it's the opposite. I probably have never worked harder in my life building a VC fund.
How's that retirement feeling, Matt?
I had my hair color before I started this. I've gone completely gray. And that's just because you just have so many more people and people's questions to manage when you're operating a fund, especially a small fund that has, you know, we have 133 LPs in our first fund. By the time we close our second fund in a few months' time, we'll have over 200 LPs across the two funds. So yeah, it's a very big stakeholder base to deal with. You will then have, you know, probably close to 70 startups in the portfolio. If you have two founders average per portfolio, is another 140 stakeholders to deal with. You then, as an operator fund, part of it, what we do is help our portfolio company to hire people and also to find customers. So, you know, you've got probably another couple of thousand stakeholders to deal with across that audience. It's a lot of stakeholder management. I love it. Yeah, and the VPs, and then like I put the VPs in the investor bucket because most of our VPs are also investors. But absolutely, the VPs, you know, their job's to make our life a little easier, and they do a good job of that.
Hopefully, we do sometimes.
I hear one in particular is a real pain in the butt.
Yeah.
Her name starts with C and ends with J.
Yeah, I don't know why you ever let her on board.
she brings good banter for sure. I think where was I going with that? Like, there's a ton of stakeholders to manage, and I love that. Like, I'm an extrovert. I love people. So don't get me wrong. Like, I go to work every day not feeling like I'm going to work. I really enjoy what I do. I enjoy working with founders and helping them to build a business. I enjoy educating investors on why this is a great asset class to get involved in and helping a lot of them make their very first step. I love working with our founder investors, people that are still operating a company, or the senior execs inside startups who have also become investors in our fund, helping them to diversify out of a portfolio of one. You know, I think like from that point of view, I get so much satisfaction from what we do and I really enjoy it. But it's definitely a hell of a lot bigger lift than I had ever imagined, anticipated when I started out, for sure.
100%. I'd like to also on record and publicly apologize to all of the investors that I met while I was raising previously, who, when they said to me, I too am an entrepreneur. I too am raising capital. I'm the same as you. And I thought in my mind, you're an idiot. Like, this is so different. You have no idea what you're talking about. I am officially sorry for the things that I thought never said to you, because turns out it actually is quite similar in many ways. Oh. And as you said, like, the stakeholder management is intense. Like, you end up, I think Nick at Blackbird was saying for Fund One, they talked to like 400 to 500 LPs. I think ours was probably similar. I mean, across my community, that seems to be like the Fund One, you end up talking to kind of, 400 to 500 people to close it out. Fund Two, I imagine it's probably similar. Like, it's not retirement, or at least I'm hoping that this is not what retirement looks like, because I'm not sure I'll still have this in the bank by the time I retire. What about from a, like, the creativity that you apply to the business model, the creativity that you apply to the product, like how you stretch that entrepreneurial muscle within the four walls of a fund. Do you feel like you get to apply that creativity in the way that you think about building Black Nova on Fund Two, and then as you start to think about Fund Three, or is it like fairly formulaic?
No, look, there is absolutely a part that's formulaic. Like the actual, you know, raising, selecting and investing, like that's fairly process driven. And obviously, you know, in our area, there are big parts of it that are human centric. And so every human, you've met one human, every human's a little bit different, a little bit special. And so there's plenty that's not formulaic about that part. But I think where I really get to stretch my entrepreneurial innovator muscle is designing the programs, the playbooks, the ways that we work with portfolio companies. And I think when you look at a lot of the VC funds in Australia, some of them are very well staffed. If you're at the small end, like we are, Maxine, they're very understaffed because you just don't have the management fee to carry a decent bench of people. And I put quite a lot of my own money into the manager to build a bigger team than most funds of our size have.
Interesting.
And, you know, I think we're also very fortunate that we had a lot of exited founders and operators and people like Cheryl and others who got involved as investors, but then became venture partners, giving up some of their time to work inside our portfolio companies. I think this is a lot of breadth, a lot of reach that we wouldn't have had if it was just the management company team. What I love, though, about being a founder fund, you know, if you look at our first fund, 133 LPs, about 100 of those LPs were operator background. You know, we're building companies, we're working in high growth startups. So we've got a really big community of people that have been on the tools or are still on the tools. That allows us then to select some incredible venture partners, which we now have 18, and those venture partners can spend up to 4 hours a week inside companies. The learnings that those people have working inside a thematic, again, we back mission critical enterprise software businesses. So, you know, if you're selling a particular type of software to a particular type of company, yeah, the price might vary based on the value exchange, but, you know, the way you sell, the types of people you sell, the buying circles, the procurement processes, you know, there are playbooks that can be built that we can start continue to innovate on over time based on the feedback we're getting from what will be a portfolio and by the end of fund two of around 70, currently sitting at 41. You know, that group of companies and the learnings we get from helping them to sell into enterprise, helping them to build products for enterprise, helping them to serve enterprise, we can over time have a really unfair data advantage and playbook advantage. That's what I love. Like, being able to work with our venture partners to build these playbooks, to be able to think about how we offer the best possible coaching, to think about how we build the best, you know, network of enterprise buyers that can buy from the companies that we have, whether that's running our own buying circle events or dinners or whatever it might be, to bring domain experts from cybersecurity or procurement or wherever together into a room and then present companies to those people. All of that stuff just gives me, you know, such a thrill, coming up with new ways to give more than just capital to the portfolio companies we back, which should, you know, and already is, I guess, in terms of the early performance, give us an unfair advantage in comparison to other funds that are playing in this space that may not have that same access.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. As someone who's like been kind of front row seat to that, I think it really is so cool how you've brought so much insight from all of these different portfolio companies, because you are in that same space, like bringing that to the table and seeing what's come through is really cool. The thing that I think is interesting though is around, like, you do B2B SaaS for, like, thematic mission critical B2B SaaS. We'll repeat that another several times on this podcast. But it's not just enterprise, right? Like, I think you specialize in that enterprise go to market motion, but also SMBs and smaller businesses. So, like, how does that differ? And do the capitalization strategies differ across whether they're doing a, like, an enterprise go to market motion or a smaller SMB motion?
Yeah, I think, look, we typically stay away from small business software. It's predominantly mid-market and enterprise. We have got a couple of investments that absolutely sell small business software. It wouldn't be the majority, but in the minority, there are some that do sell to small businesses. And at the small business end, it becomes more like a consumer sale. You know, you really need to think about your channel strategies in those instances. Like, who are you going to partner with to get your product in front of as many eyeballs as possible? Because you can't do the hand-to-hand combat selling when you're selling at a price point of $500 a month. It just doesn't make any sense. And so $50 a month if it's really at the kind of micro end of small business software. And so, you know, from our point of view, our specialty is mid-market and enterprise. When we do make a decision to invest in something that targets small business, it's either for one of two reasons. One, we believe they'll move up stack into mid-market and enterprise, and that small business is where they're starting, and we have the expertise to help them move up stack over time. Or it's because we believe that the area that they're currently playing in is underserved, and there's a real strategy to use partners. And again, we've got a great experience in onboarding and enabling partners. So if we see software that's in a category that's still paper-based or using really old legacy software or whatever it might be, and they've got a unique insight into that particular industry or area, and we're able to partner them with the right technology partners, consulting partners, you know, reseller partners, whatever it might be, because of our network, then we may take a punt on something that's a little bit kind of down the stack on the sales side than we normally would.
Super interesting. What about, I mean, you mentioned that sometimes companies, like, will do both, right? Like, you might invest in them if they're doing the kind of smaller market, even like low end of mid-market stuff, and then moving up further. For those companies, do you generally see that they, like, then maintain two go-to-market motions, or do you recommend that they, like, pick right? They like actually fully move all the way up that stack. What do you generally see kind of works for companies?
I think it's, Kate, it's hard to put a blanket statement on there because I think, you know, certain businesses, one, starting small is easier to go big than it is to start big and go small. If you have been building software for enterprises and you then want to sell to small businesses, there's a hell of a lot of rework that's required. If you start selling to small businesses, you can optimize your product to understand what the actual additional components that need to be turned on and off are for an enterprise, as apart to having to pick software back apart and refactor it later. So I think like from that angle, it's definitely better to go small to large than it is to go to large to small in terms of how you think about architecting your software. I think when I focus on sort of the businesses that have migrated from small to large, or in the occasional instance where they've gone large to small, I think that you need to determine where you're going to split your resources and whether you should split your resources. Now, sometimes you can, and that's totally okay. You know, you might have a completely different team that's on the small business product than that's on the larger business product. You probably shouldn't be doing that before $10 to $20 million in ARR. So typically at the place we play, we don't like seeing people that are trying to boil the ocean too much. We'd much prefer them to be, I've picked a segment, I've picked a category, I've picked a geography, and that's where I'm starting. And only once I've got a little bit of critical sort of motion, momentum in that area, will I think about what's the next adjacent one. That's definitely my preference when I'm working with portfolio companies.
Yeah, April Underwood from Slack has a really interesting story that she tells here, which is like the discipline that they showed before they stepped into enterprise. They were getting like tens of millions of revenue opportunity pull from enterprise at that point. So for context, Slack, I think most people probably listening to this know what that is. You know, it's a communication tool. They started as a kind of freemium tool, meaning that you could use it for free and then you could, you know, pay a small fee to be able to use it. But mostly it was like individuals buying it with their own credit card. And then at a certain level of scale, they started to kind of layer on those enterprise features. So to kind of highlight that step that you see a lot of companies take, which is like, we build effectively for a consumer or an SMB market, and then at a certain point, we then add on features to become enterprise. I think it's really interesting. It's actually really hard. Like that motion upwards, see it all the time, really common, can often work quite well. I'd never thought about the other direction. I've never seen a company do enterprise down to SMB. That's really interesting. Like that's super hard. But April,
yeah, I can't think of an example.
We did it. Yeah,
we did it
at DoneSafe, and it was really hard. Like, and you know, we at first we were trying to. So one of the things that we did well at DoneSafe, and I'd love to say it was on purpose, but it probably wasn't, was we made the software incredibly configurable and componentized. I don't know if that's a word, but anyway,
it is now.
Lots of components, very very configurable. And that allowed us to solve, you know, really big enterprise problems. Now, that solution couldn't be sold to small businesses because a small business wants to buy software and doesn't want to have the big implementation or the big learning curve because they're usually massively under-resourced as a small business operator. So they want something that's turnkey that they can just get working with, and off they went. So we definitely worked hard to build a version of that. At first, the way that we did that was because our software was so configurable, we worked with small business partners who configured our software for a small business version. And over time, we worked with those partners to then build a branch off of our product that was much more small business centric. Still configurable for the partners, but much more small business centric. So I think from that point of view, we were able to do it, but we wouldn't have been able to do it directly. Our internal team's motion was enterprise and mid-market. Like, we knew how to sell, we knew how to account manage, we knew how to do big implementations and data migrations and all the things you needed to do at the big end of town. If I'd asked any of my team to go sell to, you know, a plumbing company in Western Sydney, you know, that business absolutely needed what we had, but we were not right size to be able to help them. And so it was partnerships that enabled us to do it in that instance.
That's so funny because Maxine and I were talking about this in the prep for this episode around, like, we've seen companies that come to us saying like, yeah, we're totally going to do enterprise and SMB sales. And it tend to be like, I just don't believe that you're going to be able to do that. But there are examples, right, where like, you know, Dropbox has been able to maintain both of those go-to-market motions. Granted, maybe that's only now and wasn't how they started, but I think it's pretty unrealistic. Like, and looking at companies as an investor to think that that's going to be able to be successful.
Absolutely.
I think Dropbox ran the wave of product-led growth, free install and expansion into first paid contract. And, it started with individuals that moved to teams, and then they sandwiched it with an enterprise and partner channel strategy later on. So they very much started small and ended up big. And, I think most of the examples of companies that have gone that way, there are examples of companies that have gone big to small, but they're fewer.
Yeah. It's so impressive that you guys pulled it off, because it's super hard.
It's hard. And we probably shouldn't have. Like, if I'm honest about it, like, we probably should have just doubled down all of our focus on enterprise and mid-market and geographic expansion. But I'd always, when I started Dunsafe coming out of industry, out of health and safety. Like, I had a tech background, but I spent a few years in health and safety, and I felt like everybody deserved the right to access health and safety. And, I when I started, it was like a safety professional in your pocket was our tagline. And so I didn't want to exclude small businesses from using it, and I think had I been where I am now with the learnings I have now and the knowledge I have now, both on the building a company side and the investment side, I would have whispered in, younger 27-year-old Matt's ear and go, hey, Matt, don't do the small stuff. It's going to take you a lot of time, and cause you could just be focusing over here where you're making lots of money and the LTV is insane.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So do you see it as a risk then? Like when you talk to founders who are wanting to do both or who want to focus more on the lower market, do you see that as a risk and a reason not to invest?
I see it as a risk if they're unwilling to take feedback. I love their ambition. Like, if a founder comes to me and has heaps of domain expertise and wants to boil the ocean, I'm not unhappy about that person coming to me with that perspective. Where I won't invest is if I don't believe they can take feedback and triangulate and then work out, well, where do I start? I think that's the most important thing, is being able to take the feedback on where should I start.
I think that's a key piece, right? Like, because I think I've seen a bunch of founders do the version, like the bottom up version, like start small, get bigger, because it gets them into market quite quickly, right? They can start small in a way that allows them to start getting revenue. You saw this a lot in fintech, for example, that you would get a fintech who sells to other fintechs, who gets a whole bunch of smaller fintechs and then goes and chases a big bank, for example, because they can get to market much quicker, they can get some revenue, they can show traction and validation. But ultimately, like, the big fish are the ones that have these really long protracted procurement cycles. If you went after them straight out of the gate, like, they'd probably choke you out in like resources, because you just wouldn't have the account managers or the revenue to be able to support.
6 months later, you haven't made your first sale.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so it's like really hard.
3 years later.
Yeah. 3 years later. Yeah.
Right. 3 years later and like four team members, like full court pressing this like one motion. So I think, it can be really excellent for founders to go from going to small to big as a way of like proving out, getting traction, getting revenue, and then like earning, right, to kick off some of those longer extended sales motions, which I come back to, it makes it even more impressive. You went the like arse end backwards, where you went like big end of town first, and then we're like, yeah, why not? Why don't I add the small stuff on at the bottom, and just, pour a nine off my homies? That's really interesting.
It's funny you say that. I reflect on one of my favorite kind of memories of building Dunsafe, and when we won our first, so we had a bunch of small-ish kind of mid-market clients. We had Audi, the dealer-owned dealership in Sydney, for example, and we had very little software at this point. Like, our software was more vaporware than software. And I remember I got introduced to the head of health and safety at Suncorp, and managed to convince them that we could build what they wanted, and then managed to convince Brickworks. So that was on Friday, and then on Monday we convinced Brickworks we can do the same. And we just raised our $200,000 from Adventure Capital, so we had $100,000 of that left, because I needed $100,000 to pay off my credit card. I was getting the reminders that I just spent that on the business, and I got approval from Darcy at the time to say, yeah, you can pay that off and then just use the $100,000 to get the business off the ground and go back on your credit card if you have to. You'll still have that limit, and I won't be paying the interest on it, which was nice. Thanks, Darcy. And, we just signed these two deals, and they were both six-figure contracts paid up front, and we didn't have the software for them, but I knew it would take 6 months before they were ready to install it, because there'd be a bunch of requirements, workshops, and all the rest of it. And so I knew I could build the software as we were doing the implementation. But, like, we had a part-time co-founder and myself full-time, and two offshore Russian software engineers at the time. And here I am, trying to do sales calls while spending 8 hours on the phone getting absolutely reamed by the business analyst stakeholder over in one of the enterprise companies. And, you know, it was madness. It was madness. It was scrappy as hell. But, you know, both Suncorp and Brickworks are still customers of Dunsafe today, you know, a decade later.
Impressive.
It's even more impressive that you actually were able to, like, smoke screen that together and make it happen.
Yeah, look, and, you know, it wasn't without pain. Like, don't worry, the customer was just as unhappy as I was getting, you know, constant sort of small cuts. I had death by a thousand cuts. But, you know, we turned it around, and through good account management and through a desire to get the problem solved in those businesses, a desire to innovate, and, you know, some really, like, sort of at the cutting edge corporate stakeholders who made those buying decisions to trust a startup to do that, they ended up with the product they wanted. And, you know, yes, it hurt and it took time to get it done on both sides, but, you know, it set my business up. Like, we had six figures of revenue, you know, sort of double, you know, 200-300K of ARR on top of the 100K we had in the bank to pay our four people. You know, we were able to get it done. And so I think sometimes enterprise, although the sales cycle can be really hard, if you can find an enterprise that's willing, really wants to solve the problem, they pay up front, you know, and, like, you can use that money to build a business. So, you know, small business selling is like cold calling 1,000 small businesses to get your first customers, and then trying to convince your first channel partner to sign up, and you probably still don't have the same ARR we had of those two sales.
Right. Yeah, true that. I mean, I think part of being an entrepreneur and part of being like that DNA and the way you operate and, like, thinking about the way that you build the fund, maybe kind of the last thing I'd love to kind of explore with you is any advice for the folks that listen to this that are thinking of funds management at some point in their future, right? That maybe they have written their first angel check, maybe they haven't even done that yet. You know, from that journey, scrapping together, you know, quite a few very successful businesses now, and then now two funds, any tips or tricks that you would suggest for people?
I think if you're an angel investor that's thinking about getting into funds management, one, think about it really carefully, because it's a very different discipline from operating a business. You really have to want to do it. I'd make more money building another software business than I would running a venture capital fund, but the ecosystem will be better for it by me running a venture capital fund. And I feel like I'm in the privileged position where I can do that. You know, I get up every day feeling very privileged that I can, you know, contribute to our ecosystem and help the next generation of founders build businesses and return money to investors, which creates the virtuous cycle of more money into the ecosystem. Like, that's what I'm here for. And, you know, I think you really have to want to do it for the right reasons if you're building a VC fund. And you also have to understand what sort of VC fund you want to build. We've chosen to stay small. Like, some funds want to go and get big and get drunk on superannuation money. Other funds are quite happy to stay small and to own their lane and win in their lane. And that's where we've chosen to play. I think I would definitely get involved in a venture fund if you have the ability to do so. So, you know, a number of the bigger funds run great angel programs. Cheryl with Aussie Angels runs great angel education, and you can jump in and get involved in syndicates and get your exposure that way. And at least on a deal by deal basis, get the sense of how a manager might operate. If you have the opportunity to invest in a fund and become a venture partner, that's a great way. That's how I got started. I invested in Antler and became an Antler venture partner. I became venture partners of some other funds overseas. I got involved in some angel syndicates. I got involved in some angel groups where I could invest as a group and pull the money together. I think, you know, it got to a stage for me where I did sort of high double-digit angel investments approaching 100, where it started to become a full-time job. So a fund was the only way I could keep going. But, you know, I think get the experience and make sure you actually truly love it, because it is hard work. It's harder work than building a software business, in my opinion, after doing two and then doing this. It's a hell of a longer commitment. You've signed investors up. You're managing other people's money. It's not your money anymore. You know, yeah, your money's probably in there alongside them, which absolutely helps. But, you know, you've said to people, I'm going to give you a return. And there's a lot of places people can put their money to get a return. So, you know, there is a real sense of, when someone backs a startup as an angel investor, you write that check knowing you very likely might lose your money. When you invest in a fund, you're trusting a manager who's going to back a portfolio, and you probably don't have the same opinion that I'm okay if I lose my money.
No, you're expecting a return on that.
You're expecting a return on that. So just, I think that's the difference. Keep that in mind. You're managing other people's money, and you've got to love doing it because it is hard. It is a hell of a lot of work. There is a hell of a lot of rewards too, though. So I wouldn't dissuade anybody from doing it, but just make sure you're doing it for the right reasons.
Love that advice. So the last question we ask all the folks that come on our podcast is, what is the biggest big cojones moment you've ever had? A moment that you felt super brave?
Biggest big cojones moment? Oh, I've had a couple. I was terrified of heights. And when we signed Sky City Entertainment Group, they operate the Sky Tower. There's a video of me on YouTube. I was about 40 kilos heavier than I am now, so it's quite an embarrassing video. There was a video of me on YouTube squeezed into a flight suit with a harness around me jumping off the Sky Tower to launch Sky City Entertainment's version of Dunsafe. That, for me, like as somebody who couldn't even stand at the ledge of a window, like on Centrepoint Tower, you know, to jump off a building was pretty much insanity. I was channeling every Richard Branson book I'd ever read. You know, you get shot out of cannons and jumped out of planes for me to jump off a building. The funniest part of that story was the person who jumped off before me was celebrating her 80th birthday. And I went, God, if she went, I can't check it out. So I have to jump off this building.
I want to meet that woman. How impressive, jumping off a building at 80 years old. That is really, like, fear of heights is so real. And so I'm so impressed. You, you know, literally will do anything for a customer. That's very impressive.
I'll do anything for a buck.
But it was safe, and that is the most important thing.
It was safe. Well, I was testing the safety. They said it was incredibly safe. They'd never had an injury. So I'm like, all right, let's put it to the test.
Put it to the test. Thank you so much for joining us, Matt. This was the best.
It's fantastic having you.
Thanks, Maxine. Thanks, Cheryl. Great to spend the time.